at a time when politics are more unpredictable and more challenging than ever. But hopefully we're a little bit wiser. And I hope that we have those conversations about what can we do that's a little bit different this time, what's new, and what might get a better deal for our communities for real.
And finally, and I always like to ask this question, even though it personally pains me to have to ask it, but for those that are listening that don't feel like they know anyone impacted by AIDS or HIV, for someone that kind of is tuning out a bit because this conversation to them doesn't directly apply to them, what would you have to say to that individual?
I think it's a rare opportunity as human beings that we get to truly achieve something great in terms of public health. The idea that we finally do have scientific innovation and enough choices that we could actually end one of the most horrific, heart-wrenching public health scourges that we have ever seen throughout the history of humanity. And I think that's reason enough to go out there and say, hey, stakeholders, companies, politicians, this is a real opportunity and it's the wrong moment for us to turn our backs on that and not seize that moment. I also say to people, maybe you don't see this as something that is immediately impacting you, but the reality is that this is a virus and it can get out into broader society. And so right now,
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. KABU's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Plugged In on KABU is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
Good evening, you're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma Lugo and I'm a co-host here at Transpositive, and today we're talking today with Kayla from the Oregon Queer History Collective, formerly known as the Gay and Lesbian Archives of the Pacific Northwest. Kayla, welcome to Transpositive.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Great, thank you. Kayla, can you introduce yourself and share a little bit about your background? What led to your work with the Oregon Queer History Collective?
Yeah, I have a degree in history and anthropology, and most recently I'm a preservationist working previously and kind of for a few weeks longer at the City of Portland, and I worked on the LGBTQ+ Historic Sites Project. But I was really interested in Oregon queer history previously when I was doing my thesis and when I moved to Portland and just started researching a lot of Portland history through Just Out and archives of digital scans of Just Out, and that kind of led to me working at the City of Portland and then also getting involved in Oregon Queer History Collective. I was secretary for the last 2 years and just really enjoyed working with people who've been here for decades and have worked for decades to document and preserve our history. And in March, I was elected president to kind of continue growing Oregon Queer History Collective, working on exhibits, partnering with different organizations that, you know, we've been around for 30 plus years, and I think COVID, similarly to other organizations, really impacted the work that we were able to do. So it's been really great to kind of reinvigorate, in a sense, the organization and get queer history out in front of people again.
Great, thanks. What drew you specifically to queer archival work, and what does it mean to you personally?
That's such a good question. I originally was doing a lot of sexuality and gender history, and a lot of feminist theory, and that kind of slowly morphed into queer studies, especially after Darcel 15 was designated on the National Register in 2020. That was a big shift in my work to focus more on queer history and preserving queer history in a landmark sense. To me personally, it's been a really great way to find community, especially since I'm not from Portland. I only moved here in 2021, and at that time it was still a little bit difficult to go out and make connections. So finding that community in old Just Out articles or old materials at the Oregon Historical Society, where a large portion of our collections are housed, has been a really great way to kind of like find myself in a way and see past examples of people who've been here doing things queerly and making impacts and just living life. And I think one thing with archives that I think about a lot is just having examples of being challenging in that queer sense of like disrupting boundaries and like living for ourselves. I think a lot of queer archives just disrupts a lot of the heteronormative ways of being in the world, and I think just, yeah, having examples to look back on and seeing people who have always been different and challenging inspires me to like continue challenging the status quo.
So let's talk about the Oregon Queer History Archives for a minute. Starting with, can you tell me, why did the name change? What was the process by which it went from the gay and lesbian, what was it, the Gay and Lesbian Archives of the Pacific Northwest to the Oregon Queer History Archive?
Yes. So for a long time, from what I've heard from past board members and leadership, there has always been kind of this tension between the name Gay and Lesbian and not having a full representation of the inclusive, diverse community we have here in Portland. So that was a major touch point of just wanting to be more inclusive. We also were like, we don't really serve the Pacific Northwest. I think that became a really big thing where we're not even really serving all of Oregon.
Right,
and
okay.
A lot of our work.
Yeah.
So that helped us redefine the scope to bring it in more to Oregon. And then with the history versus archive we had a conversation that a lot of our work is beyond an archive of just collecting documents to store at Oregon Historical Society or in our own collection. So we wanted to push forward in a broader sense of history and doing public history and oral history, which is still part of archiving, but definitely expanding what is thought of with an archive. And then collective was a big push by former President Melissa Lang to just be more collective, to just kind of bring everyone in, to have everyone contributing in a way that hadn't really been going on in the last couple of decades, and really create a community around queer history that hadn't really been happening in the last several years.
Great. Well, thanks so much for explaining that. So where exactly are the archives stored for the Oregon Queer History Collective?
About 30 collections are available through Oregon Historical Society and their research library, and anyone can go there without an appointment, and you just walk up to the archivist and say you want to see such and such from the archive. A lot of our collections are also being stored by us in a process that we're trying to open more of the archives up and process more materials. So we're kind of in this trying to figure it out point of where do the materials that we store go to make them the most accessible of Oregon Historical Society, or looking to develop digital repositories through our website and a future website, or PSU, Portland State. So we're kind of in this new era of the archives because we haven't collected and processed and stored our own materials since our founding. We've always had a partnership with Oregon Historical Society, and now with this kind of change to being a collective model and being a history organization that wants to do queer history differently, we're evaluating what it means to like build our own archive. So a large part of it is in a storage unit that we're processing so that we can make them more accessible, and just trying to figure out what that means for the future.
I assume that is that expensive to do?
Yes. The storage unit is expensive, and then trying to figure out the archival quality materials for acid-free folders and acid-free boxes, photo sleeves, all of these kind of archive quality materials that Oregon Historical Society or other institutions have access to fairly easily. Being a grassroots organization, it can definitely be challenging, but we are definitely wanting to protect things in this archival quality materials so that they can last for decades, and trying to find ways to bring in funding to be able to be by community for community.
Can you tell me a little bit about the archive? I mean, if I were to just go and take a look at the archive, what would I see? Like, what's being archived?
Yeah, at Oregon Historical Society, there are a ton of personal papers from folks. I'm thinking about the papers from the Shepherds, Anne and Bill Shepherd. They were co-founders of Portland's Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays in the 70s, so a large collection is there for them. Cascade AIDS Project has materials. CC Slaughters has some materials at OHS. There's also a large batch of oral histories that were completed through the early 2000s that are digital that you can listen to at home. I'm trying to think of what else. There's a lot of newspapers, so just out there. This collection from the 70s of Gay Rights 77, which was a newsletter for the Portland Town Council. They were an organization that was pushing for a lot of the legislative protections in the 70s, so the gay rights 77 is them trying to get gay rights in 1977, and then they changed their name to like Oregon Gay Rights and kind of took that year off. There's also pride materials and photos, but a lot of it is personal collections at OHS. In our collection that we're processing, there's still personal papers, but there's also a lot of art that we're gathering, a lot of materials from QDoc when that first started, and posters. There's recently I picked up a collection from a person that made just tons of art and more kink materials, so that's been really fun to get into, and pride materials. Most recently, Kristen Knapp, who's a longtime Portland activist, gave like 15 to 20 t-shirts from prides over the last 2-3 decades, so definitely more of that object-based versus paper and photos-based.
Which is easier to deal with, the paintings and objects or the papers?
Papers, but I think the objects are more fun and reflect a different side of queer living than newspapers. I mean, I love newspapers too, but definitely the objects. It can be challenging in a preservation sense, since they're not, you know, you don't just have like a box and files. It's like having to get a custom box or a textile box to fit all these t-shirts. So in the preservation sense, a little bit challenging, but I think just as from a display or looking at it piece, definitely objects.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a little bit more to this than, say, an individual at home just storing things in their junk drawer. I mean, this is a discipline, isn't it?
Yes, and I am only a small piece of the discipline, working more with building preservation, and then there are a ton of folks joining that have experience professionally working at OHS or at Portland State or other previous archives across the country that are bringing in a lot of that technical archival experience and knowledge of storing things in an acid-free container or processing things and labeling them. I'm more on the side of like, let's document this building and get it listed to the National Register so that it's protected and documented at a federal level. So there's all these different kinds of angles that people are bringing into the collective, so it's not just sitting in a junk drawer but trying to get it out into community.
Mm-hmm. There's also a discipline or a standard for content, isn't there?
Yes.
I mean, how do you choose what to preserve?
That's such a good question. I think in the last few decades when Oregon Queer History Collective was starting, it was trying to protect people's personal materials and papers and things that were largely going to be discarded after someone had passed. Now, that's still definitely a feature of the work, but I think we're in a moment of trying to expand what we're collecting. I think I've talked about this a lot of in the past. I think there was a lot of focusing on political activism, which is important and inspiring, but now I want to expand the archive to these larger histories that aren't being as discussed or as preserved, like kink. I know there's some interest in other subcultures to be preserved. I think there is a big lack of Black experiences in the archive and Indigenous experiences, bisexual experiences, so now trying to focus more intently on connecting with communities so that the archive is a full reflection of Oregon's queer communities. There was another part. What was your question again?
I was just asking about how you choose what to curate. Oh,
yes, thank you. So that leans into it. It's also still a matter of like people emailing and being like, I'm moving or I'm getting rid of this stuff. Do you want it? So we'll pick it up and kind of look at it. There's, in that archival sense, it's kind of a, I want to collect as much as people want to give us. So there's not super definitive, like, we're not going to accept this, we're not going to accept this, but some of the folks in the archives committee is trying to create those boundaries of what do we give to Oregon Historical Society that they'll have interest in, and what do they not have interest in, so that we can keep those materials and be in community some more of those ephemera, posters, t-shirts, maybe. So it's an evolving status of what we're wanting to collect. As far as my work with preservation and where I want to go there with Oregon Queer History Collective being involved in landmarking, that's kind of a open field of a lot of criteria as well. And in Oregon, you need owner consent to landmark a building, so that kind of narrows what we can do, but definitely wanting to preserve open spaces and different built environment pieces and reflections that Portlanders have gone to that have been significant since the 70s and beyond. Like Darcel is an example of a bar. And then in 2024, I helped designate Irvland Field as an example of an open space connected to queer history. The Crystal Hotel is on the National Register as a bathhouse. So just trying to get more of those spaces and using the archives to help document and uplift those stories.
Portland had bathhouses?
Yes, there were so many bathhouses in the 70s, and the Crystal was one of the most prominent. I think now there's only like, what, two or three?
I have no idea. I've never been.
Yeah, me neither.
But thinking, I remember in the movie, and the band played on.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. It was just all about the bathhouse scene in San Francisco, like basically in the year or two right before HIV kind of. It was really good. I mean, it really, I don't know if it was accurate, but I mean, it captured a certain kind of scene in it. It did it very respectfully, you know. I mean, anyways, I didn't know there were any in Portland.
Oh yeah, there. The Crystal, do you know where the Woodlark Hotel is downtown? That was a bathhouse. There was where Terry Shrunk Plaza is downtown. That was a bathhouse that they demolished and then named after a really homophobic mayor. There were not in the sense of like gay bathhouses, but in Old Town and Chinatown, there were bathhouses. So yeah, they were kind of all over downtown.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, how do you capture, I mean, ever since the advent of online technologies, the vast majority of queer culture has become digital. And I mean, even when it comes to organizing, I mean, queer people don't necessarily produce newspapers anymore. They don't even really write letters. I mean, queer history now is text messages, WhatsApp threads, Signal chats, you know, maybe from 10 years ago, like Facebook groups or something. I mean, how do you capture that, or do you?
Oh gosh, that's just such a good question, and I feel like I am still trying to wrap my head around how we're going to do that. I think because Oregon Queer History Collective in the last couple of decades since its founding has been really focused on pre-1994, trying to get, coming out of ballot measure 9 that attempted to criminalize and erase queer communities, so really focused on early periods. We're still trying to figure out how to document even like the mid-2000s.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'll just leave that for the future.
Yes.
The future will take care of it.
Yes. And yeah, there's so much out there. Even someone was saying, you know, we should document the pictures that are pinned on Google Maps of Crush after that closed.
And right.
Oh my gosh, mm-hmm. That's a whole other ball field. So yeah. I definitely am looking to the folks coming and joining the Archives Committee who have professional experience in that kind of born digital media. And it, definitely trying not to focus on it because it gets so overwhelming of just... even the list you listed off is there's so much.
And yeah.
I think that's where objects become more interesting to me because of that lack of physical newspapers. What are objects that are reflective of queer community today and what will that say about our experiences to the future?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about Crush for a minute. Maybe you could tell me about Crush as an example. Like, if you were some hypothetical future archivist and you were trying to tell the story of Crush, like, how would you archive something like a space like that? How would you approach it?
Yeah, such a good question. I think there's two different ways that overlap. From my preservationist building landscape perspective, I would definitely be looking at building plans and building permits and sandborn maps to try and figure out what the space was before it became Crush and during Crush and understand any modifications the building went through and try and capture that architectural detail. Then I'd also be looking at newspapers and archival materials like photographs or oral histories to try and find out what people were saying about Crush or what went on at Crush to try and document its significance in the community. From a more archival standpoint, would definitely be focused on the newspapers and oral histories and photographs, and then maybe more of the like posters from inside Crush, if that was possible, and posters of different events. I'm trying to think of what else would be... Do they have, like, t-shirts? I went to Crush one time before it closed, so I'm like, do they have merch? Because I think that's something that's really cool to see. Thinking of other queer bars in Portland that have really iconic merchandise, like Darcelle's at one point had this kind of, like, leg cup. Kind of like the lamp.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. So I'd try and look for that. And then definitely talking to people in community to see what they have. I think a lot of archival work and connecting with community, there's this sense of like, well, my stuff's not important, but it's like, no, I still want your stuff because it adds to our understanding of queer experiences and lives, even if it's just... I don't know what would be really basic, but just anything reflective of people's lived experience in Portland, even if they think it's not significant, it can be significant.
So jumping around just a little bit. Oh, first of all, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Transpositive, and we're talking today with Kayla from the... we're talking with Kayla from the Oregon Queer History Collective. Kayla, what's some of the earliest material you have in the archive?
Good question. At Oregon Historical Society, we have trial papers from 1912 when 68 men were arrested for same-sex activities. So there's about three different trial papers that we have copies of that you can go and read the... testimony of people involved in these cases, and it's really interesting to understand how they were viewing sexuality and same-sex sexual activities in the 1910s. There are instances, or earlier occurrences, of course, of Portland queer communities before 1912, but that definitely is a murkier time period where people aren't saving or being out as queer. So I know there is some materials from Marie Equi that's available, both at Oregon Historical Society, and I think someone told me like the FBI has records of her activities, but definitely trying to think. It's a lot of like 1912, and then from Marie Equi, there's a scholar, Michael Hellquist, who wrote a biography about Marie Equi. That's a really great resource, but definitely trying to go earlier, it's harder to find a lot of resources, and a lot of the materials that Oregon Queer History Collective has collected and preserved is kind of the 1973 period to like 1994.
How's the archive at preserving and documenting the history of the Black, Indigenous, and people of color community in Oregon who, you know, have queer identities?
Historically, not well. Mm-hmm. It is a huge gap in our collection, and I'm really excited to make connections with other organizations that are collecting those histories, like Oregon Black Pioneers or Albina Vision Trust. They might not actually be that historically focused, but like Vanport Mosaic and Naya, and kind of building overlaps and connections so that we can increase that history, both queer history in their collections and BIPOC histories in our collections, and also connect with